It has been a terrific day, and I'm really happy. And I must thank the organizer for giving me the chance to present some of our work. So today I will talk about the diet and human microbiota, spanning from nutritional studies to mathematical modeling. I will want to make a few points about the diet impact on healthy adults. Most of the study deal with either obese or overweight patients or individuals or elderly. So those individuals are pursuing a calorie restriction, and the goal is to have a weight loss. And Wu et al. Pointed in their supplementary information that in their individual, is it working? Anyway, they pointed that the BMI is the major parameter explaining microbial diversity. Other study and many study will provide a supplementation with a commercial formula. You've seen many with prebiotic formula and protein beverages. Recently, a very nice piece of work by Peter Turnbull described, it's one of the few dealing with normal BMI American, describing drastic diet change from animal protein and fat to plant-based diets, and I think it's a very interesting study. Otherwise, long-term survey and cross-cultural comparison have shown, have pinpointed that over time, diet would change over a long period of time. It's more like a regime change in ecology. And there's not enough study on ancestral humans, and this one is unfortunately just in vitro. So the conclusion is we don't have a good understanding of the impact of diets on microbiota and in the prevention setting. So regarding fibers, if I quote Berkeley, it is known since 1972 that it has a role in the prevention of certain large bowel and other disease in the Western countries, but really lacking precise information of the role of the microbiota. So the French National Nutrition Program recommend an increase in 50% of the amount of fiber in the diet by the addition eating more fruits and vegetables, but also carbohydrates, especially grain, pulses, and whole wheat cereals. Fibers have been recognized as playing a beneficial role in human health, mostly by the supply of vitamins, short-chain fatty acid, mainly through microbial fermentation. They help weight management and gut health, mostly by the bulking effect on transit time and stool frequency, and preventing effect towards cancer has been described. So 25 grams of fiber per day is what's supposed to be necessary to maintain a normal bowel function. And the consumption in the US and in Europe is around 18 or 15 grams per day. So we decided to study the impact of fibers on the microbiota of French adults through a grant from ANR. So this trial is registered, and it has been performed at the Center for Human Nutrition in the Alps in Grenoble. We provided real meals, controlled diets. They were omnivorous meals designed by nutritionists and made at INRA. And fresh fruits and produce were added. Because the composition is shown below, the only difference is the amount of fiber, 10 gram or 40 gram, provided by the actual normal diet. So the cohort is was purposely quite narrow in the fact that the individuals are quite similar. I mean, there were 19 omnivores, young, adult, lean, living in the same town in Grenoble. The study lasted for 7 weeks, as shown at the bottom. And first week was the baseline, then the first diet arm for 5 days, Monday to Friday. Then they can let it go and eat what they want for the washout periods over the weekend and for 2 weeks. Second diet period of 1 week, and then the washout. And the individual came several times, and we took at least 6 sets of samples. So we analyzed the microbiome composition and the function, and I will walk through some of the data we obtained. So first of all, we're looking at the 16S DNA, focusing on several groups using qPCR. And what we're looking at here, What we're looking at here is the microbiota trajectory through the entire diet experiment. So just look at the numbers for now. baseline, point one and two correspond to this baseline. So you see that the points are rather close and quite similar microbiota. Point one and two, the blue ones, are close, but they are different. So what is the difference between the yellow and the blue? Well, the trial was a crossover, so the nutritionists split randomly in two groups of 10 and 9 individuals. No metadata can differentiate those individuals, but we can see already that their microbiota at the start of the clinical is not identical. So let's go to the first diet period. So we're moving from 1, 2 to 3, 10 grams of fiber here, and 40 grams of fiber you end up here. So you see a drastic change in the microbiota composition. Then the 2 weeks washout, instead of bringing you back to the original, puts you back here at these 2, 4 points. Second diet period, you are actually at number 5 here, and look at how those are quite similar. We can discuss that later. And then second washout, you are getting slightly closer to the initial, but not quite yet. And those 2, 6 points are kind of closer to this one. So what explains these changes? If I show you the groups that are significantly, when you're moving towards the x-axis, you are decreasing the amount of the Clostridium coccoides, cluster 14 cluster, and then Clostridium lecto, some of the firmicutes. When you're going up on the y-axis, you statistically increase the amount of Bacteroidetes, E. coli, and Bifidobacterium. So I'll let you look at the figure and think. So the diet effect is very quick, and you're decreasing in the firmicutes. Washout doesn't bring you back to the original composition, and you're getting back some of the Bacteroidetes. And then second diet puts you central. Look at the firmicutes going up. And then last washout puts you here. So it's quite interesting to see that those groups are really modified during the trial. The points are the centroids, and as you can already guess, those thin lines are the individual variability throughout this experiment. So we went ahead and we did pyro sequencing, and I want to show the individual variability. Let's see. Now we're looking at the 16S sequence, focusing on the 14 dominant genera. That's 95% of all of our sequences. And what we're looking at here, we're going to be looking at the trajectory from the diet 1, the washout, and the diet 2. We do a triadic analysis to map those individual trajectory. It looks a little bit messy, but let's go and look at, for instance, in the center, the individual number 7. So he's going through a diet, washout, and then second diet. Not back to the original, but not a lot of changes. Number 20, somehow the response we were expecting in such a narrow cohort of individual, diet, washout, and then diet, washout, and second diet. And you can already see maybe some of the genera that are the most modified in this trajectory. Now let's go to some drastic change in number 6. Number 6, diet, washout, and then second diet. And 14, it's a little crazy. I don't know if I can follow. 14 starts here, D1. Also have change in infected bacterium, and then back in the Bacteroides. So it seems like the individual variability is quite large. And this 2D representation is good and show like a large variation between individuals, but we went ahead and precisely calculated the actual really distance, not just on 2D. So we calculate the Jensen-Shannon distance, and two things here. The blue ones from the qPCR seem to, those are the starting with 40 grams, they seem to be more impact on the qPCR, but it's not true here. And if you look at the total distance, meaning the distance within those 14 genera, the diversity doesn't move. It's really a shift in the community. So this distance is not significantly different from the two groups, but between individuals, there's a factor of 3 in some of them, like 14, for example, is here. So how can we get more information on this genera? We only had 19 individuals, but we have several time points. So we were able to pick 7 genera that were that allow us to cluster those microbiota over time in 18 different groups. It might be difficult to look at, but horizontal is the profile distribution of a genus, and then the groups are, the individuals are here. Let's just look at the distribution of some of them. What it means is the way the Prevotella and Dialister are profiled means that they show a discrete distribution. So those genera will really stratify the microbiota. For the other genera, it's less clear on our data set. But let's try to look at some of the individuals we looked at. Number 20 didn't seem to move much on the previous slide. And yes, he doesn't. The microbiota doesn't change cluster. It's always in the Prevotella-rich bacteria that test low, as you can see here. Number 6 is more interesting. It's more dynamic. So from the few time points to the last washout, it moved dramatically from this high Prevotella, low Bacteroides, into the high Bacteroides with an increase in Faecalibacterium and Ruminococcus. And number 14, and other microbiota moves throughout the clinical intervention without any interpretation we can have on those. So I think it's very interesting to look at. We may need to work more on this cluster win. We may need to ask Dushko's advice. We use the tools that were used by Mani, but still. And interestingly, Prevotella, it's been discussed in that recent paper from Weinstock. There's a lot of talk about Prevotella because we don't have much commensal isolate from the human gut. Most of the information we get come from the rumen, and there are discussion about whether it's more linked to male and female, but we really didn't see that. So the microbiota is changing through the nutrition. Do we see the different function being expressed? We did the transcriptome to look at the microbial gene expression in this individual. So we kept 23% of the cDNA reads after removing the ribosomal sequences. And interestingly, in collaboration with Bernard Ernst, we were able to get the annotation of the casein family. Those are carbohydrate active enzymes. And we had 73 family expressed. Not all of them are involved in polymer degradation. Some are involved in cell wall, but we detect a lot that were involved in fiber degradation or mucin degradations. I don't have time, but in this project, we also built metagenomic library and screen for the expression of this enzyme, and if you're interested. The next step, we focus on the statistics comparison of this 10 gram versus 40 gram. It's not that we focused. We didn't have money to sequence more, so we only did a transcriptome after 10 gram and 40 gram, diet 1 and diet 2. So some of the interesting results, if you look at the hydrolysis, we detect the glycosyl hydrolase 13 starch degradation. It was overexpressed. And then the xylan, the family of glycosyl hydrolase targeting xylan hemicellulose were downregulated here and here. Does it make sense? Yes, especially if you look at the menu, the diet, at day 5, it consisted of potatoes for this group. Mucin degradation families were underexpressed. This one was statistically, and then some GH for which we don't have any annotation. So further down the pathway after the hydrolysis, in terms of fermentation, we didn't see any butyrate gene or reductive acetogenesis genes being overexpressed, but the genes responsible for the production of methane from hydrogen CO2 were expressed significantly more at 40 grams of fiber, and it makes sense. 50% of the individual produce methane. Now, unexpectedly, let's say, the vitamin B12 pathway were underexpressed together as phage. One-third of our sequences of our read did not match on any database at the time. We have to reblast. And among them, 6 gene clusters unknown were upregulated after 40 grams of fiber. Sorry. So the genes, some genes were overexpressed. What about the products of the microbiota? Short-chain fatty acid and DNA protection are supposed to be related to fiber. In our case, I'm not so surprised, we didn't see an increase of short-chain fatty acid with fibers. There's interesting correlation here between Olcibacter and this molecule. Olcibacter, we don't have any isolate from the human gut. The closest 16S correspond to a species that was isolated from an anaerobic canal of a seafood mussel, and it's actually known to be producing virates, so it makes sense. Regarding DNA damage, we performed the routinely used COMET assay, and you expose the HT29 cells to fecal water for 30 minutes, and then you measure the DNA damage by this migration assay. If the DNA is not damaged, you get this type of migration. DNA damage will extrude out of the nucleate, and you'll get the COMET tail. No effect of the diet on the COMET assay. What we saw, and it's true for all the individuals, we saw a correlation between 7 bacterial groups and the COMET assay. I explain. This individual here in blue has more representation of this species or genera. The individual in red show more Rhinococcus, Dystrophobia, and Sporobacter. So if I want to conclude on this part of the study, I plotted in blue the between diet effect and then in pink the between individual effect. Those data, there's co-inertia, so we could do this analysis. This is PCR, pyro sequencing, all genera, dominant genera, and core OTUs, and short-chain fatty acid. Regarding gene expression, I don't have much statistical power, but it's very different if I look at all the CAHO. It's 1%, and then if I look at the casein, that's like 10%. So both diets and individual are determinants in the response to the diet. The fiber increase did increase the expression of genes processing available nutrients. It's not new, some other reported the same thing, but also the expression of unknown genes. We didn't see an increased production in short chain fatty acid. Can't say that it play a part in the protection of host cells. If we were to do it again, of course, we would want to type the individual's microbiota before a trial. It will, I think, help us understand their dynamics response, whether or not their microbiota is sensitive, resilient, because I think it's disturbance and resilience. I added this slide because we talked a lot this morning and this afternoon about window and resilience. So I'm convinced that studying the healthy gut microbiota will help and will inform on the personal nutrition treatment in healthy or in disease. But I think we need to avoid some of the anthropomorphism in our interpretation of the data. I just quote some of the things that we say or we hear. The microbiota adapt quickly, it's resilient to antibiotics, it shows mild dysbiosis, I apply the strong stress to the community, without really sometimes having the data to support that. So those two graphs show the ecological definition of disturbance and then resilience. So the community matrix is usually shown here. It doesn't have to be diversity, it can be other markers. Let's imagine in the context of the study I just talked about, the diet was a pulse disturbance. It means a short disturbance that has a quick, an important effect quick, but the microbiota, the effect can be reversed rapidly. So the definition of resilience is the rate at which a microbiota go back to its initial point. 95% in my case would be the dominant genera that I talked about. And then the microbiota that is sensitive can go and stay in what's called alternative stable state. But the individual variability is so big, was so large, that I'm not sure the washout didn't bring the microbiota back to normal. So when I apply my second pulse, that I think is my second diet arm, some of the individuals didn't move, so they might be here. Some are still probably here and didn't go back to the initial point. So by applying a second pulse disturbance, I am exactly right here, or some individual microbiome might just not be sensitive. We have to think of that in the context of designing the experiments, but also in the cohort of patients. Some disease might just be long-pressed disturbance, and so in this case, the disturbance is so long that only a minority will go and be resilient, and most of them will stay in this alternative stable state. But we need more definition. We need to understand these biases. You've probably seen this landscape in ecology. What it says is that the environmental change and then the resilience of a microorganism will let the community in this state, unless you have a strong triggered or environmental change that would put you into this alternative stable state. And so we don't really know when you study disease individual if we are here or in the middle. And the key point is to sort of being able in the healthy to measure this funnel, the diameters and then the length, the slope. It will help us understand these biases. We need to formalize, and then we need to maybe add a little bit of theory and mathematics. So I'm getting to, I don't know if I need to put this in front of this audience, but we need to get into mathematic modeling. Why modeling? In the industry, the goal, and it works, is to control the system, be able to monitor and have an action on the system. In microbial ecology, I think the main point is the better knowledge of the complex microbial community, especially dynamics, spatial distribution, well, data integration, you know. Sometimes it will tell you the key parameters. They're not the ones we think. Detection and replacement of missing data and experimental plan. Hopefully it will help predict dysfunction, but in the healthy, really fine determinants of variability. Very quickly, there's a very nice review that you can look at. There are two main modeling approach. The top-down one is the one where you map your data onto existing model, and you probably use this a lot. It relates to statistics, mining, bioinformatics, and you can detect relationship networks. Most of the study dealing with microbiota and PCR analysis fall in that category. It's also called reverse engineering. The second type of model is a little bit different because you start with system knowledge, you study the interaction and the topology of your system. You will be building a new model structure. So if the electron tower to you sounds like the name of a movie, then you fall into this category. If you like partial differential equation, but you also like reading old books about microbiology, you know Cumming and McFarlane 1981 by heart, and you're very familiar with Dr. Abigail Salyer's work, and you fall into that category. She just passed away last year, and I wanted to give her a tribute for all the work she's done. Look at her publication in 1978, and it makes you humble. So that's what we decided to do. And we actually can get information for other systems because the anaerobic pathway are shared and central. Termites, rumen, humans, and anaerobic digester have the same central metabolic pathways for dealing with polymer degradation into either short-chain fatty acid or methanes. Practically, in anaerobic digester, they design a very good anaerobic digestion model, and we use the structure and the kinetics pathways to build our model. Well, we consider the human gut as a set of different reactors. We show the proximal transverse and distal colon and the rectum. There are three different mini reactors, the lumen, the mucus, and then the host. Digested food enter here, and then at the end, this plug flow reactor will end up here. Mathematically, what we do, schematically, we will cut a slice of the gut and make a mass balance in this slice of what's in the flux in and out, the anabolism and the loss, and then derivatize that over time. The speed will be the transit time, and then X would be the position in the colon. So we do that in all this area. On top of that, we modify the ADM1 metabolic models to fit the human colon, and we read a lot of the bibliography. So we represent the main pathway of the carbon trophy chain in that first model. So the polymer degradation into the glucose, the fermentation, hydrogen, CO2 converted to acetate or methane. And then what we added, the complexity of the human gut that was not in the digester. See, all the interaction with the host, the short-chain fatty acid absorption, 95% of them, and then the biomass, and then the mucus layer. Interaction and flux, I'm not going to detail this one, but we had desquamation of host cells. This is the host cells here, the lumen is in blue. We had the peristaltism, and that was part of the Raphael's work, the building this model, sorry. So to summarize this modeling, the first part of the modeling work, using knowledge and literature, we built a new math model. The structure of this model was very complex. It had more than 300 parameters. So you need to simplify the model at that time. So Raphael used different techniques to decrease the amount of parameters. And then he set up new tools to estimate some of those parameters. Now, you need to validate the model, not just in silico. So what we did, we used all experiments that we had done in the lab previously or that Harry Flynn gave us. So meaning that we have data for small boxes in the big model. So we use the small boxes to validate the parameters of our model. So it was butyrate production, the two lactate used to produce butyrate, and then acetogenesis from my PhD work. Using that, the in silico model was validated in silico. We obtain on MATLAB fast fiber response. But also, I want to point out that the model picked and pointed some measurement that we need to do, the diffusion through the mucus, which molecule are able to diffuse in the mucus. We need to do that to understand and to have the model work properly. Lumen mucus shedding were confirmed in the model. Then the model pushed you to do in vivo experiments. Some of them are nutritional studies, and some of them deal with the synthetic microbiome. What are we doing now? We are trying to map the metagenomic data onto this model because we built only the main function, the main kinetic reaction. So how we do that? We use the HMP and then the MetaHit catalog. Soon we'll be hopefully able to search in the new 10 million gene catalog. We look for specific genes related to the trophic chains I was talking about. We'll look for functions that may not be mandatory but are important for this trophic chain. So we collect those reactions, and then it's a little bit tricky to get the cow. We look also for glycosyl hydrolase, and then we build this big matrix, as you can imagine, of individuals and then the reaction, adding the counts. From those big matrix, what Sebastian is right now doing is processing them to get informative profiles. So there's several different options. You can do mathematic regularization, you can do statistics assays of robustness, but what we're focusing now is add biological constraints on this trophic chain profile. And what we expect to do is get more information of the dynamics of those functional profile and of this important trophic chain in the healthy. Also, it may point at which metabolites to monitor throughout intervention study. So I'm not going to talk about metabolomics because Alien Health did an outstanding presentation on metabolomics. I just want to present quickly one tool that we developed and adapt with Trent Northern at the Berkeley Lab. It's called NIMS for Nanoinciter Mass Spectrometer Imaging. And to present it simply, Trent designed a chip that is coated with a specific compound that allows, during laser ionization, to ionize most of the molecule. And then from that, it's pushed in the tuff. What you get is a full mass spectrum every 30 microns. So the laser will beam every 30 or 50 microns on the chip. You get a lot of data. After image analysis, you can go untargeted or targeted, but if you go targeted, for instance, here, it's on the patient sample, you can get spatial distribution of specific metabolites. So the goal is to apply it in conjunction with nutritional study. It has to be fast, and it has to be non-invasive. Urine or serum metabolomics are fantastic. What we decided is to set up a finger metabolic imaging. We call it the skin touch assay. It's very quick. You just have to press your finger on the chip, 5 seconds. There's no pre-treatment. You can store the chip, or you don't see the fingerprint here, okay. You know, you can analyze part of the chip or the whole chip. Same as before, you get a full mass spec. Targeted or non-targeted, and so you can detect what? Microbial communities, chemical exposure, or production of biomarkers. I'm not selling a magic tool. There's some very tricky part. If you go non-targeted, it's very complicated. The amount of data is huge. But you can go targeted. You can analyze 15 fingers very quickly. I'll give you a few examples of what you can detect. You can easily figure in a cohort on a set of different individuals, specific ions that are on an individual's fingers. You can also, security and cosmetics are obvious, so you can actually show the presence of iron specific if somebody touched gunpowder very recently. And more interestingly, for microbial metabolites, you can get very nice, here it's the total intensity, and if you really know what you're looking, if you target, it's being, it's here, it's not here. So with this, I want to wrap up by thanking, well, Joldor is not here, but I'm coming from his team. I was going to say from his enterotype. But so we've learned so much. I've learned so much with him and from him, so I'm really thankful to Joël. So the study, the nutritional study, was done in Grenoble, collaboration with Bernard Henrissa. And then the students who did the work, Julien Tapp did most of the work. Colleagues at AMIPEM helped us. And mathematical modeling has been going on for a few years with my collaborators, Beatrice Laroche from the math department, and we co-supervised two PhD students, Raphael, who did the work I presented, and Sébastien. And the ongoing collaboration with Trent Northern. With that, I'll thank you, and I'll take questions.